let's talk and let's laugh, cause I got so much to tell you, so let's go kick some art, art, art. Go kick some art, art, art. Go kick some art, art, art. Welcome.
Kia ora, and welcome to Kickouts with Emma and Stephen, proudly sponsored this month by our friends from the Dolphin Theatre. Head to dolphintheatre.org.nz to check out their latest shows and book your tickets. Kickouts is Aotearoa's comprehensive art show brought to you on Planet FM 104.6 and streaming live around the globe thanks to our podcast, which you can download from planetaudio.org.nz or find us on Spotify. Tonight's show, we're in Zoom land, as both Stephen and I are away with our whānau. But we have three superb interviews about music, writing, and an upcoming production. All this and, of course, a whole lot of music. But to kick it all off, I ended last week by saying we were ending the show with a song from the Tati Iwi, People's Choice winners from the Aotearoa's Music Awards. But we ran out of time, so let's kick it off with Borderline. And that girl.
Holding on.
bit different tonight. As I said in the intro, Stephen and I are both away with our whānau. Stephen's in Australia. I'm down in Christchurch. So we headed into Zoom land. But having said that, it's been a very busy week. Stephen's across in Australia watching VCA's dance show, as well as attending Waitress. And funny story, when you go to a theatre in a different country and you end up sitting next to someone from Aotearoa. So that happened to Stephen this week, but we'll talk to him about that next week. And I've had the kickoff of Hadestown Teen Edition at the Pump House, which is actually, by the time you're listening to this, now closed. What a hit. Pretty much sold out 6 shows, and thanks to everyone that came. But anyway, we're going to crack straight into our first interview. Now on Kick Arts, I have the pleasure of being joined by 3 students from ACG Strathallan who are currently working on their college's production of Bugsy Malone. Kia ora, guys.
Kia ora.
So I'm going to start by handing the microphone. We've only got one microphone in this pre-record, so, you know, it's going to make it interesting. No one's going to talk over each other. But I'm going to hand the microphone to my anti-clockwise, and I'm going to ask, tell us, what is your school production this year?
Bugsy Malone!
So cool. Now, let's find out who we've got in the room with us, because our listeners might like to know.
Hello, my name is Parneet, and I play Fat Sam.
Hello, my name is Ryan, and I'm one of the conductors.
Hi, my name is AD, and I play Blousy Brown.
So cool. So, first of all, let's go back to Parneet and tell us, what is the kind of gist of Bugsy Malone? What's it all about?
Pretty much, it's a mafia gang war between two bosses, Dandy Dan and Fat Sam. And Fat Sam gets the help from Bugsy Malone. And if he comes to the show, you can see who wins.
Okay, so a mafia gang war in a high school. So is there anything that kind of takes it away from being rough and ready?
Well, you're not necessarily going to watch a war movie like The Godfather. Instead of actual warfare, guns and bombs, we have custard pies and silly string splurge guns.
Splurge guns. Now, that sounds like fun. It kind of reminds me of What Now and the slime, or the, what was the stuff that used to come down in What Now? They got gunged. Yeah, cool. See, I don't know. Maybe I'm showing my age. Maybe What Now don't do that anymore. You know, they threw the contest, the
Nickelodeon slimed?
Nickelodeon did slime.
Yes, I've seen that.
There we go. Now, Ryan, you're in a bit of a different position in the show because you're not on stage as such. So tell us, what do you do in this musical?
Well, you can find me in the orchestra pit. In Act 1, I play the trombone, and in Act 2, I conduct the band. So I work with all the onstage people, work with the crew to form the second half of the show.
That's so cool. Now, how long have you been playing the trombone for?
I have been playing the trombone since 2022.
Oh, so that's maths. Oh, my goodness, maths. That's 4 years.
Pretty much, yeah.
Cool. And was trombone the first instrument you played?
No, I picked up the piano when I was around 5, so quite a while ago.
Was picking up the piano a heavy thing?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Was it something that you wanted to do then, or was it something that was like mum and dad knew that music would be a good thing and got you to do it?
I think it was mostly my choice. I was influenced by my grandparents a lot. They used to play the piano, so I got very inspired to learn an instrument.
Cool. And was it classical all the way to start off with, or was it kind of this jazz vibe that like Bugsy Malone is?
No, I was all classical until I picked up the trombone.
That's so cool. And then conducting as well. How does it feel to be someone of your age in charge of basically controlling the whole show when it comes on stage?
I feel very, very privileged, and I'm very honoured to have this opportunity to have been given to me. And I'm very honoured to have been able to work with such an amazing band.
That's so cool. And training to be a conductor, what do you do to learn how to be a conductor?
I think for me, most of it's intuitive since I've been doing music since I was a kid. So not much training, to be honest.
Okay. Yep. Fair. Cool. All right. So, Parneet, tell us, what is your role in the show?
Pretty much I'm the angry lunatic in this whole show. So there's two gangs. There's the smart gang, which is Dandy Dan's, and then there's the stupid gang, which is my gang. And pretty much they'll be going face to face and seeing who can take over the American state.
Crazy. All right. So you're a nasty gang person. What is your most favorite part of the show?
I think it's just yelling at my gang and just being myself on stage. Like, there's just a really nice art of being on stage and just, you know, being there.
Fair cool, fair cool. All right, over to you, Atia. Tell us a little bit about the character you play.
So, taking a different turn from Parneet's character, I play an ambitious singer wanting to go to Hollywood, and she pretty much just does anything she can to make sure she gets there, hence meeting Bugsy Malone. She is very strong, very resilient. She gets to hold a bat, which I'm very happy about because I get to look pretty cool with a bat. And yeah, and I get to pie someone in the face at the end.
Do you get pied?
No, because I'm pretty cool, so I can swat it away.
So tell me a little bit about the style of music, because when you say to someone, we're going to go and see a musical, I think they automatically imagine jazz, box steps and, you know, kind of American music. So tell us, what's the music like in Bugsy?
This musical is very surrounded by jazz and lots of blues scales, blues music, jazz, all of that stuff, instead of a jukebox or just a different genre in general to what people would normally think. Yes.
And what's your experience with jazz music?
I really love jazz. I've grown a strong liking to it since 2023 when I was roped into the school jazz band. Vocally, I think it's very complex and very amazing. Just a different form of music in general.
And when did you start performing?
I started performing when I was about 5 or 6 years old. I got put on stages and stuff during my childhood.
Cool. All right. And how many shows, like, you're in year 12 this year, so is this your fourth school show here?
I have performed in 3 school shows and was backstage for 1 show.
Fabulous. And do you have a favorite moment in this musical?
I do really like my solo song at the end, near the end of Act 2, and it's called Ordinary Fool, and I just get to perform and sing.
Very cool. Now, I reckon that we should have a quick music break now, and we're going to play a song from the show. And because you've just mentioned Ordinary Fool, I think we'll play that. So here's Ordinary Fool from Bugsy Malone.
Have I missed?
Vibe. Now, you've been rehearsing for a little while. When did rehearsals kick off?
At about the start of February, we started our rehearsals. Started with leads, and then ensemble got gradually introduced into the rehearsals. We do two times a week.
Now, I probably should ask, who is the artistic team on the show? Who's directing you?
Ashton Brown. He's one of our external directors who has come aboard to help us with the show this year.
Fabulous. And then, of course, you've got Mr. Mackay, Josh Mackay here, who's the head of music, who's leading things up. Who's choreographing?
Our friends Maddie and Emily. Maddie and Emily are both students of the school, and they have taken up the role of choreographing every piece in our musical.
That is so cool. So what have rehearsals looked like?
Pretty much we have gone through Act 1 and Act 2. We had our King's Birthday rehearsals last week where we spent Friday, Saturday and Sunday going through the whole act and polishing everything up. And yeah, it's been great.
Cool. That's pretty intensive though. But I suppose at least you got Monday off, right?
Oh yes, definitely. At least you got a holiday.
Very cool. So what are the next steps forward from here?
We will be going into the theatre very shortly, Hawkins Theatre, and we'll be practising the week up to the show.
Very cool. Well, Ryan, tell us, what does it mean to pack in or bump in, depending on what you call it, into the theatre? What does that look like for the orchestra?
It's not very pretty, to be honest. We have a band of over 20 people, and we have to fit it somehow under the stage with everyone's instruments, everyone's equipment, and everyone's accessories. So it'll be a nightmare to pack in, unfortunately.
And who gets to kind of boss everyone around? Is that a you thing or is that a Mr. Mackay thing?
Hopefully it'll be me, but if he doesn't let me, then Mr. Mackay will do that.
Fabulous. Now, have both of you, Parnit and Atia, performed at the Hawkins Centre before?
Oh yeah, I've been performing for a while, so I did theatre classes like back in 2018. So my first show was actually Goldilocks on Trial, and then afterwards I stopped going to the rehearsals and I joined Strath, where I started their first production in 2021, which was Grease. So this is my sixth show at Strathallan.
That's so cool. So tell us, what do you like about the Hawkins Centre?
It's actually a really nice space. I think it's a very wide open area and everyone is just can fit in quite nicely, minus the orchestra, sorry. But it's honestly, it's such a privilege to go there, I think. Compared to other places I've seen, I think it's one of the best in the area.
Very cool. And it's nice and handy for anyone that hasn't been to the Hawkins Centre before. It's really easy to access. Like, a lot of people seem to think that Papakura seems like a very long way away. Not so much for the kids here at Strathallan, because most of them live around this area. But anyone that's travelling to Papakura in the Hawkins Centre, I mean, you come off the motorway at the Karaka turn off and you turn left and then left and then left again into Elliot Street and you're literally right there. And there's a huge car park. An even bigger bonus, car parking is free. It's not like going to the Civic where you pay $12 to park for the night, or in some cases actually $20. So it's a good place to be. Okay, what part from now going forward are you most looking forward to in this process?
the actual performance days, which are on the 18th, 19th and 20th of June.
That's so cool. So how many performances are you doing?
We are having 4 performances, 1 on Thursday night, 1 on Friday night and 2 on Saturday, 1 in the morning and night.
Very cool. And what is Ryan, what are you most excited about when it comes to the process going forward?
I'm most excited about moving into the theatre and actually working out the production as how it's going to be on the performing nights.
Yeah, that's so cool. Well, I wish you all the best for your performances for the rest of the 2 more weeks of rehearsal and then getting there. And I can't wait to be sitting in the audience to watch a little bit of Silly String and a lot of custard pie.
Now, staying a little bit with the scheme of things, our next track that we're going to play is actually the award winner from Aotearoa's Music Awards for Te Manu Taki Māori o Te Tau. That's Best Māori Artist of the Year. And that went to Tawaz, T-A-W-A-Z. And we are going to play their track, which is Towers and Mellow Downs with Kawakawa Tea.
Could have the baddest curves in the world. She could have the nicest perfume I could smell. She could drive around in a Rover, but it really don't matter when it's over. She could wear a mini skirt never works. She could wear designer and I still know no look. She could be a teen with some fringe, yeah. Getting close, wanna pass my danger. Ooh, sipping major like it's Kool-Aid. Yeah, I like the way you grind all on my ure. You so fire, butterflies in my fukue. Me catch a fire, papi, got me feeling. Sipping major like it's Kool-Aid. Yeah, I like the way you grind all on my ure. You so fire, butterflies in my fukue. Me catch a fire, papi, got me feeling. Natural like kawakawa tea. The love you're giving me is Māori healing. Natural like kawakawa.
I just picked 10 kawakawa leaves.
The love you're giving
baby.
Me is Māori healing.
Let me pour you a cup.
All the bad girls to the front. Mellow down season, let me give you what you want. I'm in the walker or the blunt. Never putting on the front. She looking very nice and she very innocent. Manicure nails, picking her from the crap. A good girl, love a bad man straight from the block. She answered the door, love her and a crop top. You can be my lover, we can ride, got me feeling. Sipping major like it's Kool-Aid. Yeah, I like the way you grind all on my ure. You so fire, butterflies in my fukue. Me catch a fire, papi, got me feeling. Sipping major like it's Kool-Aid. Yeah, I like the way you grind all on my ure. You so fire, butterflies in my fukue. Me catch a fire, papi, got me feeling. Natural like kawakawa tea. The love you're giving me is Māori healing. Natural like kawakawa tea. The love you're giving me is Māori healing. Natural like kawakawa tea. The love you're giving me is Māori healing. True like kawakawa tea. The love you're giving me is Māori healing.
Now joining us on Kick Art from her living room / office / lots of walls of books, it tells us often when someone is surrounded by books, they read lots, which hopefully equates to them being a good writer. So here is Marie Connolly, who is here to talk about Icefall. Kia ora.
Thank you, Emma. Kia ora. Lovely to be here.
So now, this is the second anticipated crime novel from you, following the first, which was Dark Sky. So now tell me, what is Icefall all about?
Well, Icefall is, as you say, it's a sequel to Dark Sky, and it's another gorgeous part of Aotearoa. And so It's set in Aoraki, Mount Cook, and a body pops out of the glacier, the Hooker Glacier. And so what happens when a body is lost, it pops up eventually, usually. And so that's what's happened on this occasion. And that's where it starts. We've got the first mystery, which is the body. There's no records of that, of a death. We haven't got any idea who that was and how they got there. And so the first start of the book is about the receding glaciers and the body popping up in the glacier.
Tell me, how does a writer come up with a starting point of a body coming out of a glacier?
Well, I think that's a good question. Mainly, I think my type of writer, I'm a place set writer. Some people write plot first and others start from their characters. But I tend to start from gorgeous places. My first book was set at the Mount John Observatory in Takapo, and I managed to bump off a professor of astronomy in one of the telescope domes. And so it's one of those places that is isolated and beautiful. And after I wrote that book, I wrote it really because I went stargazing at Tekapo. And then I start to think about what other isolated places are gorgeous and where would I like to spend some of my time? And so that was when the notion of the glaciers came up, and Aoraki in particular. And bodies and other things do pop up on glaciers right across the globe. So it is a thing. We know that it happens, and it's happening increasingly because the glaciers are retreating. And so that got me intrigued about it. Now, what happens when a body pops out of a glacier? How does it get there? How long has it been there? Does it come out where it fell in? And so the story started from there and then takes us into Christchurch. So there's a couple of strands to this novel. It's a bit different from my first one, which was a murder at the Mount John Observatory. This one has a number of things going on. There's lots of moving parts to it.
That is so exciting. Like, and I think it's beautiful that this is not just a novel and a murder mystery. I love that you've incorporated an environmental message in a way as well as showcasing a little bit of Aotearoa.
Absolutely. And what I've done with this one, well, I do it with the other one as well, actually, because I'm not a mountaineer. I've never been mountain climbing. And so the notion of a body falling into a crevasse and then coming out again is so outside my knowledge and experience. First thing that I started to do was to talk to my favorite glaciologist, Heather Purdy, from the University of Canterbury. And so then I start to learn more about that. I went down there and we went on a helicopter and landed on the glacier. So I got a feel of what it was like, because I'm never going to be a mountaineer. And so the only way I'll get onto a glacier is by being taken up there. But being there and suddenly feeling the grip of not just the cold, but there is an edge, obviously, to being there, because people are taking sometimes their lives in their hands. And so there's that drive that people have to climb mountains. And that was the other thing that I wanted to know about. You know, I think that compulsion almost to go up to our highest peaks and risk your life doing that. And it's cold and it's harsh and it's beautiful. So it's got all of those elements to it. And then I spent time with the search and rescue people. You know, what do they do when a body pops out of the glacier? And so they took me around the station there. They took me into the place where if people have an accident, they will be brought in. So this, it's like a little medical center with all the equipment that you need to respond as a first responder. And there's a tackle room with every type of thing hanging, hooks and ropes and all kinds of things hanging all around the room. And there's a whole row of jackets in different colors that indicate what the role of the person is in that rescue. And it tells me so much about the importance of color, because it's not going to be a very good idea if you go up there in white. You'll just get lost. And so there's all kinds of quite small things that become quite important when you're up there. And so it's been a marvelous treat for me to not only spend time there, but also talk to people who have had a life of climbing the mountain or working down at Airaki. And it's just such a privilege to hear them, really. And they get a kick out of it, because suddenly there is a murder in their midst and their work comes out as part of that.
So I have these images.
That's exciting for all of us, I think.
I think it's extremely exciting. And I've got these images going through my head right now of you, I'm thinking, on a boat maybe in the Milford Sound, or I'm kind of going, where in New Zealand could be somewhere exciting for you to go in the future to have some lived experience?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Have you got any dreams?
I really find it fascinating that we have such beautiful places, and I love the notion that there are dark things happening in our gorgeous environments. I am thinking a little bit about the next one, because I'm keen to get onto. I'm keen to develop Nellie Prail, her character in all of this. And so we actually went north to, stayed in the South Island, but we went to Kaikoura. And I thought, this is an interesting place. So we'll watch out for that, I think.
Maybe a body gets washed up amongst all those seals lying there on the rocks.
Exactly, or the whales, or whatever. I mean, it's funny. This is only my second crime novel, and I've written lots of books, but they've been academic books, and so this is my first ones. And suddenly, I'm starting to see the potential for dark things happening everywhere. When I look around, I think, oh, this is interesting. You know, that could turn into something. So I'm still in the excitement phase of writing these novels.
Now,
and they get me around the country.
What research did you do to know how to write a crime novel? Like, did you watch lots and lots of TV programs? You know, were you one of those, what was it, Murder, She Wrote back in the day? You know, what was it that sparked that?
Well, it was, I do watch a lot of crime on TV, and I do read crime novels, and so I enjoy them. But that's a relatively recent thing for me to do. I thought crime might suit my writing style a bit better than perhaps other types of literary fiction, because my writing style is very tight. And when you're writing academic books, there's no spare words. You're engaging the audience, but it's very different. And so when I first started, I wrote a novel over lockdown and it really wasn't very good. And it was a type of literary novel. And so I realized that I needed to find a genre that was perhaps more in keeping with what I'm good at. And so I read a few Naomi Marsh books, and I started to, because she's a very good writer of plot, and I thought that's what I need to know. I needed to modernize it, of course. But when I look at crime fiction and when I look at crime on TV, I tend not to really like the serial killer end. So I'm not down that end of the spectrum. And I'm not really up at the cozy end either. So I realized quite early on that I like that middle ground of whodunit type stories where you have a puzzle and you have a number of possibilities, and it started to take shape. So I like the plotting and the planning of it, because that's a bit of an exercise in finding out who did it for myself. And sometimes it changes when I start. I have an idea that this is where it'll go. And then another character comes out that seems more interesting or maybe fits the scenario better. And so I do some changing and shifting. And I quite like that flexibility. But it's got constraints as well, because whodunit type of books, the readership have certain expectations about it. And I've noticed that particularly this time around, positioning it there, I need to think about how I engage people in that story so that they, for those who want to, that they can puzzle their way through it and see if they can crack it.
Love that. Now, as I said at the top of the interview, for our listeners who can't see at the moment what I'm seeing on Zoom, you've got a lot of very full bookcases. Now, if I was to sneak into your bedroom, though, which is a little bit different than a bookcase, who would I find on your bedside table? Who are you reading at night to put you to sleep?
Well, I think I do read crime novels, but I actually read a lot of things. I'm reading at the moment The Meaning of Trees, which is a gorgeous New Zealand book about how we've used plants and trees in Aotearoa. And there's a story around them. There's a history to them. There are different ways in which we use them. Some are poisonous to us, others aren't. We use them for medicinal purposes or whatever. And so that's a fantastic book. But one of the curious things about it is I think, oh, that's interesting. I could use plants in my books. You know, there's opportunities. So I tend to read quite a lot of nonfiction. And then I read crime fiction. I read a really remarkable one called The Good Father. I don't know whether you know that one, but Liam McGillivray is a professor of Scottish studies down at Otago, and he wrote this book called The Good Father, and he broke all the rules about how the expectations around a crime novel. We get to the middle and something completely different happens, which isn't usually the structure. He plays around with the structure quite a lot. So I like to see how other people write and then see if I'm courageous enough to adopt it in this being so new at writing these things.
Beautiful. Now, there's a question that we do ask a lot of authors who come on, and that is about the way you go about writing, your process. Do you have a special spot you go to? Is there a certain time of day you prefer to write? How do you go about it?
I'm completely undisciplined in my style. What you can see behind me actually is where I will write, but we only moved into this house last week. So that's what all the boxes are around me. We're still in the process of moving. But this is the desk that I use. But much of the time in the plotting stage, I have large pieces of paper and dates and things that happen. So I plot it quite carefully. Otherwise, I lose my way. And that often takes quite a few months to settle into what I want to write. But then I just write compulsively. I sit in front of my computer and nothing, I think of very little else, and I can talk about very little else for a few months because I'm a quick writer and I'm obsessive. It's probably one of the more challenging parts of my personality. I tend to really focus on it and then I leave it for a long time. So I will write the first draft and then let it sit and then start thinking about what do I need to do to improve that. So I do quite a lot of quick writing that then I hopefully improve, although I do wrestle with sentences quite a lot. So I do focus quite a lot on the sentences and the making sure I can make it as good as it I can do. But it was funny with my first novel, because I've written such a lot of books, I've written over 30 books, but they're not in this genre. They're not in fiction. Mm. And when I finished my first manuscript of Dark Sky, the editor said to me, "Oh, no, you know, Marie, we're going to be passing this backwards and forwards about 5 or 6 times." And I thought, I don't think so. Surely not. It's not going to need that. Surely it's, you know, it's. I thought it was actually pretty much done. Well, did I find out that wasn't the case? You know, it certainly wasn't done. I rewrote chapters. I developed characters. I did a lot of things. With Jane, the editor who worked with me on Dark Sky and on Icefall. And it's just such a gift to work with an editor. You know, they are looking for the things that sometimes a writer can gloss over or not pay due attention to. And they look for the flaws in the writing, and they look for the flaws in the character development, and have you got these things right? And it's, I really enjoyed that. Mm. After the first surprise that was my future for another 3 months, it was a real gift to have a sharp editor who is experienced and knowledgeable looking at this and, telling me what she thinks it needs.
Now tell me, because this is the second novel in the series, do people need to have read the first before they read the second?
No, I don't think so. We worked quite hard to make sure it was standalone. There are references back to the first novel here and there, but I was talking with somebody the other day who had read it, and she hadn't read Dark Sky. And she said, it's interesting because she said it just reads like a standalone novel. So, no, you don't need to read Dark Sky. But if you want to know a little bit about Nellie, and she's the criminal psychologist in my novels, I like good, strong women characters and good, sharp, young women. And I have a number of them in this series. But if you want to know a little bit about her, Dark Sky was her first murder, and it was all about the excitement for her of working with the police. Icefall now, she's settling into it a little bit. And she's finding it's not quite so easy as she thought it was before. So there's a bit of a development of her character over the books, I hope. That's what I'm aiming for. Some people are interested in a love life too. Other people are more interested in the science. It's very interesting when I hear back from people. I get quite a lot of feedback from people telling me what they particularly like. And often it's interested at who's on the horizon for her. And is she going to take up with anybody in the books that we're looking at? And so it's really quite interesting to me. Different people want different things. And I guess what I'm trying to do as I go on is to bear those things in mind. Some people want to wrestle with the whodunit. Other people don't. They just want to absorb it and, you know, turn the pages. So I think there's lots of variety and diversity in our readership, and that's something that I really love to hear from people about. What did they like about it?
Fantastic.
And now, what they didn't like about it, maybe.
Well, that sometimes helps as well, doesn't it? Now, so
it does.
Have you started writing the next book in the series?
I have indeed, Emma. I have started to write it. And it is set in Kai Koura, but I'm not saying anything more about it.
That's
you're going to have to wait
fine.
For it.
Well, because according to what you've said, if it's about a 3 months for the first draft, then a bit of a wait, then some backwards and forwardsing, it may mean that book number 3 might be out by the end of the year?
I hope so, yes. I'm certainly hoping so, and I'm aiming for that. Now, what the publisher thinks is another matter, but he's been really terrific and committed to the book so far, so here's hoping.
Fantastic. Well, listeners, you need to get along to wherever all good books are sold and find Ice Fall on the Shelf. And thank you to Quinton Wilson Publishing for publishing that. It's only been out for just not even a month yet. So get to the bookstore.
No.
Get it. Have a read. And maybe tell us via KickArt what you thought of the book and what you're looking forward to in the next one. Thanks so much, Bree, for coming on. It was so interesting. I could talk to you for much longer. And we'll definitely have to catch up at Christmas time when book number 3 comes out.
Thanks, Emma. I'm looking forward to it.
Now, I have to say, that was such an exciting interview. After we got off, well, after I stopped recording yesterday, we were just saying how her descriptions gave such an amazing feeling of being there and how fantastic it was that by having those lived experience, how they were able to then be relayed onto the page in such detail with so much colour and look. So thank you again, Marie, for such an amazing interview. Now, our next guest is currently home from London, but I'm not going to say too much, but I am going to play a track.
Said I'd be moving to London, and I just fall into something. Jump off the plane, I'd see your face, and I fall in love right away. I thought it would be so easy, maybe it could be that easy. But I'll never know, cause I'm stuck on you, and I don't want to be. What if I spend my whole life waiting for someone who doesn't even want me? Worried that I'll wait until I die. Wait until you're ready. What if I spend my whole life turning people down until you say you miss me? Worried that I'll wait until I die. Sometimes I dream we're together. That makes me feel so much better. We start again, right where we left. All of our feelings the same. Maybe it could be that easy. I wish it could be that easy. And I know I shouldn't be stuck on you, and I don't want to be. What if I spend my
messy. And what if his mom doesn't like me? And what if it's boring too quickly? And what if one day you decide that you're ready for me? What if to spend
thrilled to be having this next interview. It's early in the morning and we appreciate that it's never a cool thing to have to be talking at this time of the day. But for this amazing Wahine, she is home from London. Although, I'm not sure if she calls London home. Maybe we should ask her. So, kia ora, Phoebe, how are you?
Kia ora. I am very well. It is early. I'm not normally up this early. But I'm very happy to be here. And yeah, I don't know if I call, I think I call London home. I think I call London and New Zealand home. Like if I'm in London, I'll be like, I'm going home soon to New Zealand. But then when I'm here, people are like, when do you go home? And so I think they kind of have both ended up being my home, which is nice.
So how long have you actually been out of Aotearoa now?
I moved almost 6 years ago, which is so crazy because it feels like it's been like maybe 2 years. But I think because I come home so often to New Zealand, it kind of feels like I never left, I guess. But yeah, almost 6 years.
That is crazy. Now, tell us, how did this journey start for you? Like, what got you into the music industry?
Well, I was singing opera as a kid, and I always thought I would end up being an opera singer. And then when it was time to go to uni, I was going to do classical voice. But then I heard about this pop music degree that I had never heard about before. And so I auditioned for that with the first two songs I ever wrote. And then I did the pop music degree at Auckland Uni, and it was like the best thing I ever did. It was so amazing. It really changed my life. And then after that, I started releasing songs that I was just writing with my best friend who I met at the degree, Josh Naley, who's like an amazing producer. And then a manager reached out from England who had found my songs on SoundCloud. It's actually so random. But I think a good lesson that you just have to put stuff out, because otherwise it's impossible to find somebody who has never like put themselves out there. So I think, yeah, just putting stuff out really is how I started doing music.
When did you write music when you were at school, or was that also, only start with the degree?
Yeah, no, I never even really thought about it, and I didn't even really listen to pop music. I really only listened to musical theatre and opera, kind of classical music. So I don't even really know what made me do, something called me to the pop degree. But no, I wrote my first two songs I ever wrote for the audition, and they were truly terrible. But they must have seen something in what I did. So yeah, no, I didn't write growing up.
So tell me, we quite often ask artists who come on, what's your process when it comes to writing a song? Mm. Is it lyrics first then music, or a bit of both together, or does it vary?
I definitely do both together, but I do a lot of collaboration. It's very rare these days that I write on my own. So most days I'll go into a room in London with like two other people, and we all write in the room together. And so it's not insular in the way that I could kind of choose how I want to do it every day, because I have to consider the other people in the room too. I think I would struggle to like sit down and write one or the other without thinking of the other one. I definitely think most people do them at the same time. It just makes it a bit easier, I think, at the other end.
And apart from the fact that you're working with other people, which probably helps determine what you're writing about, where do you find most of your inspiration comes from for whatever the song is about?
Well, at the beginning, when I was starting to do my own artist thing, I was definitely writing about my personal experiences. But it gets to a point where you kind of run out of things to say about the things that have happened to you. And so, because I now write every day, it's my full-time job. And so it would be borderline impossible to draw from things that have happened to me every single day. So I guess with the collaboration, it makes it easier because somebody else might come in with a story, or if I'm writing with an artist, we'll write about what they're going through. But if I'm just writing a song to then pitch out to any random artist, generally we'll think of like a cool word or maybe a cool phrase and then go from there, which is like not really an ideal answer, because I guess you would hope that all music comes from like some place within you that you have to get out, but I don't think that is the case.
But I think that's really important, for we get a lot of young musicians listening to the show, and I think that's a really important thing for them to realize, that maybe, you know, there's no formula and there's no right and wrong.
Totally. Yeah, it's super different every time, and that's what I really like about it, actually. And I think that's why I can do it every day, because every single day is so different. And yeah, it's just so fun. It's fun to just write what you think is like a fun thing to say, or yeah, it's really fun.
So you mentioned that growing up you did a lot of opera and musical theatre.
Yes.
How do you think, in what way do the experiences you had from doing musical theatre and, yes, and opera earlier, how is that put into your life now? Like, does it help or...
Yes. Oh, I think that I really, really think that every human should have to do children's theatre. Like, the things that I learned in children's theatre as a child will never be... I could never have learned in any other space, I don't think. Like, learning to be comfortable in front of other people, which is just what life is. You're always in front of other people. It's impossible to ignore. But also learning to tell stories and be, you know, imaginative. And when you're in the rehearsal room, you have to imagine what it's going to be like and feel like and look like. And none of that stuff is there. I think all of that comes into play. But also even just like my best friends who I have now, I met doing children's theatre because we had this shared thing that we loved that wasn't, you know, like partying and dating. It was like when we were going to do Sioux School the Musical next. And I think that was really important. But especially for my songwriting, I think I draw a lot of inspiration more from musical theatre, I think, than the classical and opera, although those are both dramatic too. But I think, yeah, I mean, every single day I think about a musical theatre song when I'm writing a pop song, because it's the best form of storytelling, really, I think, that you can find. And so, I don't think I could do what I do now had I not grown up doing theatre, or, you know, I still engage with a lot of theatre now.
I love that. I love that. My mind is pinging as to where I can put that little sound bite, because, man, there's a lot of adults out there that need to understand how important it is for their kids. What were your parents like growing? Were they supportive of this journey? How did they feel about you jumping on a plane and going to London?
Well, they didn't really have a choice but to be supportive, because I'm very, I've always really been sure of who I was and what I wanted, but they were extremely supportive. But when I moved to London, it wasn't really even something I wanted to do, but it was just during COVID. Before COVID, I was going back and forth a lot. And then during COVID, you couldn't go back and forth anymore. And so my manager at the time was basically like, you need to either move to England or kind of stop doing music, because there's the way that I wanted to do music was full time and in a really big capacity. And that just doesn't really exist here. And so he was like, you just have to go. And so they had to be even extra supportive because I was feeling really panicked about it. But my dad's from England and he grew up there, and so it didn't feel like this big, huge, different thing to him because he knows England really well. But they are just so supportive, which is funny because no one in my family is musical, really, apart from my granddad. But like in my immediate family, all of them are like quite sporty. And so I think I was very confusing to them the whole time.
I love that. I love that. Random question now.
Yeah.
What is the biggest thing you miss about New Zealand? Apart from your whānau, when you are in London, what is the biggest thing that you miss?
Oh, that is such a good question. I do think just community in general is something in New Zealand that is really hard to replicate in any other country. Aotearoa has such a beautiful way of, like, I just feel like even walking down the street, everyone's smiling at each other and saying good morning, and that's not happening in London. If you try to smile at someone on the tube, it's like carnage. It's just not a good idea. So I definitely miss community in general. But also, I guess, I think the food here is really good. And I don't know if it's because it's the food I've grown up with, but I do find myself very excited to go back to Countdown on New World when I get home, on Woolworths, I guess. And like there's certain restaurants that I've loved and I think just feel nostalgic. So yeah, probably those things, I guess.
If there was something that you could, or is there something that you bring home back to New Zealand with you that you think New Zealanders should have from London?
There's this candy called Percy Pigs that they sell at Marks Spencer's and it's really banging. And I think every country would, I think we could end all conflict if Percy Pigs were available worldwide. But
that. So it's a suitcase. So we know when you land in New Zealand, there's a suitcase full of Percy Pigs for all your friends.
Yeah, and they're going to have to call me aside. Yeah.
I love that. And then when you go home, you can put in your Tim Tams and your pineapple.
Totally. And also, there's like these chips here called Cheese Apinos. I'm always taking those back for all my New Zealand friends who live over in London. So it's really just snacks. I'm just like a snack mule across the borders.
So just out of interest, you say all your friends in London. Did you find that when you went to London, you discovered there were, like, do Kiwis orientate to you because they know you're there? Like, do they hear you and go, oh my God, you're from New Zealand?
Well, I moved first and I lived there for like maybe 18 months before my friends joined me. But since then, truly, I've probably had like 10 of my best friends move over. And most of them I met in children's theatre. So we're always talking about like when we did Joseph when we were kids. But yeah, I think it was just like after COVID, you know, there was that kind of mass exodus of people my age and lots of my friends decided to move to London, which was so epic because that first year was pretty lonely. But it was actually kind of nice because it meant that I had to make British friends too. Whereas if I had moved with my New Zealand friends, I would never have tried to make any others probably because I just really like them.
Well, we're going to, we've played, of course, at the start of the interview before you came on, we played Till You're Ready. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit, what was that, like, where did that come from? Where was that in your art journey?
I wrote that song actually years before it came out, but I always really loved it when I wrote it, and I just love a big kind of pop song, which people kind of shy away from because it's not like the coolest version of music, I don't think. But I love pop music, and I love a sparkly pop song. So I wrote that with my best friend Rory Adams and a producer called Martin Sholey, who's a genius. And we actually wrote it on Zoom, which is so crazy. And then I recorded the vocals in my parents' house because it was during the pandemic. And then a few years later, I just really still believed in it. So I posted a snippet of it on TikTok and it did kind of well, which then forced my team to let me put it out. And then it came out and it actually did really well in Aotearoa. And I'm really proud of it. And I love that song.
Amazing. Now, you mentioned TikTok then. How much of your mahi is your promoting yourself in social media?
Well, when I did the artist thing, which I don't do so, I more write for other people now, but when I was an artist, I mean, I had to figure out how to like TikTok. And the way that I got there, because it feels kind of inherently evil to have to do that, but actually, it's almost like you get a free billboard and it's either going to go up on the side of the road in Gore or it's going to go up in Times Square and you don't know which one it's going to go up in and you just have to roll the dice. And because one day it will go up in Times Square and everyone will see it and it could change your life. And so I had to just reconcile with the fact that it could be a really life-changing thing. And I've seen it change so many of my friends' lives. And so it felt, you know, achievable, but it's a tough relationship to think that you have to put yourself out there in that way. Is, you know, I can understand it's terrifying, but I do think it's worth it. And that's where I landed.
Beautiful. I love that. Now we're going to end your interview because I know that you've got an important meeting with people back home. It's amazing what Zoom does. Who would have thought before COVID would we have realized that we would be doing all of this kind of stuff online. So maybe there were some, if we're looking at the positives out of the pandemic, there it goes. Now, we're going to end your interview, though, with another song of yours, So Scared to Be Happy. Tell us a little bit about that. Give us a little bit of an insight.
I wrote Scared to Be Happy on my first trip to London, my first writing trip, and it was so scary to go in with these people who have been making music for a long time. And I remember sitting down and kind of just like word vomiting how I had felt about a recent breakup. And I was getting to the point where I wasn't that sad about it anymore, but that was kind of terrifying because then, you know, you're moving on in some way. And I had vowed to everybody that I would never move on. And so then I was going against my word. And my mom had said to me, like, I promise you one day you'll be happy. And I was always being like, you're wrong. You don't know me. And I was reconciling with the fact that she actually was right. And she actually knows me more than I know myself. And so we wrote this song about how it's like scary to feel happy again after you felt such despair. And it's a song I could only have written when I was, you know, like 23 and everything felt really dramatic. But it's a song I'm really proud of. I love this song.
Beautiful. Now, tell us, where can people follow, find your music, listen to you?
Well, my artist name is Navy, which is N-A-V-V-Y, because I'm an idiot. And it's that everywhere. Yeah, you should just be able to find it there.
Fabulous. Now, we're going to end your interview. Would you like to introduce your song here on Kick Arts?
Sure. This song you're about to hear is called Scared to Be Happy, and I hope you enjoy it.
You break up two times, the first when you leave, the last time you cry. I haven't cried over you in a while now. But that's not to say you with her didn't hurt. Took hundreds of nightmares, I ran through the worst. Breaking old habits, learning not to need you. I could stay a whole life way together, but you took it from me, gave it all. In traffic after hours, someone's cut me off. No, I don't need you in those moments anymore. I should want a party, but that means I'm moving on forever. And I've thrown away everything we used to be. No, I'm not ready to admit that I don't need you anymore. I could see a whole life way together, but you took it from me, gave it all away to her. That I guess I'm proving me wrong. Damn, I'm strong. So why now that I'm moving on, am I set to go? And why now that I'm letting go, am I scared to be happy? So why now that I'm moving on, am I set to let go? And why now that I'm letting go, am I scared? You break up two times, the first when you leave, the last time you cry. I haven't cried over you in a while now.
Well, what an awesome interview and also amazing music. So make sure you do check out Phoebe or her artist name, Navy, with two V's. Now, of course, we've been playing music last week and this week of award winners from the Aotearoa Music Awards. And during those awards, there was an amazing speech that has been posted in so many places made by Dane Linda Topp, which was truly emotional for so many reasons. And I suppose the first reason, of course, was that only a couple of days before, her twin sister Jules had passed and was finally at peace after her battle with cancer. So Linda even being at the event was huge. But she stood up, and in her 7-minute speech, she included a request for more funding for the arts. And it was a plea. It was definitely a, this is not good enough, something needs to happen. Now, Paul Goldsmith was in the house, and his response that came out later via reporters was an interesting one. You know, he basically brushed it off and said that, typical, you know, blame us, basically. It's the same old cliche every time, attacking a centre-right government, was his response. I think as an artist, I know how frustrating the whole funding thing is. Nobody really ever knows where it sits and where those goalposts are going to be. And it takes hours to do a grants application. It's crazy how long that takes. You know, and I don't know, how do we fight for a bit more help from the government? I mean, budget cuts for arts funding, you know, constantly. For 20 years, according to CEO Gretchen LaRoche, Creative New Zealand has been trying to increase our baseline funding with no success. Creative New Zealand can only give us what they have. Now, I know a lot of their funding, about 70%, comes from lottery grants. And then the government contributes. But what the government contributes is relative in comparison to what they give sports and what they give other areas. I suppose this is something, don't get me started, but if we don't start, if we don't all start, how are we going to make a difference? I don't know. And I mean, is a government change going to change anything? I mean, we just need to look back at what people turned to during the pandemic. It was the arts. Suddenly there was crafting. Suddenly everyone was downloading movies and listening to music or singing themselves. You know, I just think it's so important. And I also think it's so important when people like Dame Linda gets up, they're the voices that need to be heard. But I'm going to step off my soapbox right now and hit us with another amazing Kiwi artist and their latest song. This is Kaylee Bell with Once in a Lifetime.
Who'd have thought I'd be on the big stage with my guitar and my best mates? It's like somebody made a mistake. Who'd have thought a girl from a small town would play her songs to a big crowd? And cloud nine never ever coming down. It's been a long time waiting, looks like we made it. And some bright lights. Let's spend tonight making memories. 'Cause right now
I got on my little bandwagon before that song, and while that song was playing, I was also on the Big Idea and came across their article from the 28th of May about what this year's budget means for the arts. And I just thought we'd talk about it just for a few minutes. So the government requires 2% baseline savings from arts, culture and heritage agencies it funded. 2%. Might not feel like much, but that 2% is going to ripple. It's going to spread across every funded cultural identity, including the Ministry of Culture and Heritage, Creative New Zealand, New Zealand On Air, Radio New Zealand, Te Papa, Te Matatini, the New Zealand Music Commission, NZSO, and more. So what does this mean? Well, Prime Minister Luxton has confirmed that the net operating package would be $2.1 billion rather than $2.4 that was set in the policy statement. The government wants to return a surplus and is pursuing it through tight controlling of operating spending. Okay, cool, fair enough. It was never going to be good through the eyes of generosity. It's nowhere nearly as bad as what it could have been. So let's have a quick look. The budget directly addresses the creative sector. It allocated $460.7 million for 26 and 27 and $1.7 billion over 4 years to the arts. Alongside this investment, the government has required all agencies to vote to contribute 2% baseline saving package. That's $27 million over 4 years. $27 million. Like, that's just crazy. Absolutely crazy. So there's a few wins. The New Zealand Film Commission is gaining $800,000 specifically to manage the rebate. Te Papa, although contributing to savings in this budget, has had its baseline funding increased. Losers. New Zealand On Air is the largest contributor to savings over the 4 years. That includes a total of $13.8 million over 4 years, including a total of 5.6 savings. Well, that's a huge reduction. Creative New Zealand faces a $1.3 million cut. Te Matatini faces a $1.5 million cut. These cuts are over 4 years. The Symphony Orchestra, New Zealand Symphony Orchestra, $1.4 million cut. Wow. Royal New Zealand Ballet faces 568,000 cut. I mean, it's just crazy. And all these cuts just keep on going. And, you know, in arts education, if government funding per student does not keep up with inflation, well, how are we meant to provide arts? How are we meant to pay for classroom specialists? How resources, you know? How are kids meant to have the experience if there's not the money put in? I could go on and on and on, but maybe we need to actually have a Kick Out with some funding people. I don't know. Anyways, so back to Kick Out. We, as we've mentioned the last few weeks, are getting really full really quick. And I think it's super, super important that if you have something coming up, even if it's in the distance right now, that time is going to come around so fast. Let us know. Book in now to our schedule. We're taking bookings right up to the end of the year. So send us what you'd like to do. And we will book you in a time on your preferred date to come in for an interview. It's quite funny, actually. It kind of, again, buzzes my brain's snapped out to somewhere else. And that is people actually booking early. So not just for interviews here on Kick Arts, which is what we're talking about. But I have to say, we've got to get out of this habit of waiting to the last minute to book for things. Like, as a producer, it's really stressful sitting there not knowing if tickets are going to sell. And then suddenly it's bombarded with tickets and it's all fantastic, hopefully. But what can we do to get people back in the mentality of booking early? I'd love to hear your ideas. Maybe we need to start a post on Facebook about, or Instagram about this one, a bit of a ask a question poll type thing. Because what is it that we can do to get people to schedule? I understand that we're still a little bit post-pandemic when everything was being cancelled, but that's not really the case now. So, you know, get in there and book. Get in there and book. That's all I'm going to say. Gosh, I am on a bit of a rant tonight, aren't I? And back to what I was saying before, we would love as well to have some music to play. We love supporting new artists, old artists, artists returning, anyone at all. And we would love to play your music. So you can email us at info@kickarts.org.nz. Make sure you're following us on Instagram and Facebook as well. That's kickarts.nz. Now, I know I've got another busy week coming up. In fact, the next few weeks are absolutely crazy. So, just closed Hadestown, popping to help my son move flats in Christchurch, which means I'm actually also managing to catch up with the Anne Juliet tour and see it a couple of months on since I saw it up here in Tamaki Makaurau, so I'm really excited about that. Then Wednesday night, I'm having the immense pleasure of being at the opening night of Heather's here at the Civic, and that is going to be so exciting. What a cult, phenomenal musical. Stage Antics are actually producing it in September up here, the teen edition of it, and those kids are so excited about getting to see the show as well. So not too sure what Stephen is up to. I know that next weekend we have a pretty full schedule with both of us back, and that's going to be really cool too. So I think it's time to take us out with some music. I'm watching that timer go down so that I can definitely play one, if not two songs, and just trying to think what that might be. Again, I'm going to say a huge thank you to our sponsors, Dolphin Theatre, and for all of our music. If you want some good Kiwi music, you can't go past the new Hatchlings Spotify playlist. It's updated every single week with New Zealand artists and their latest tracks. And it's such a good way to hear someone that you normally wouldn't. Like, hit on some of those tracks. Listen to someone new. I challenge you. Give that a go. Now I'm just rambling a bit really to fill in time so that this track plays out. But anyway, like we've said, send us what you would like to hear as well. Like, is there someone that you would love us to interview or a topic you would like us to talk about? Remember to email us at info@kickarts.org.nz. Also, have you checked out our website? Find out what events are on. And again, if you've got an event you'd like to list there, send us an email for sure. Now, we're going to end the show finally. Enough of Emma's rambling. As I said, back in the studio next week. And we're ending tonight with Flynn Adamson with his latest track, Warm. I want you to go out there and, as you know, kick some ass.
Don't you go loving someone else if you don't know who you're loving.
soul loving someone else, baby, if it ain't me. And I've tried to explain my words don't come out, baby. Don't you go loving someone else, if it ain't me. Else, I just think of you. I tried, but it's old news. It's when I try somebody else, I come back to you. Come back to you. I've been on a train, should be coming home to you. 18 mistakes, too young, don't feel for you. Don't you go loving someone else if you don't know who you're loving. Don't you go loving someone else, baby, if it ain't me. And I'll try to explain, my words don't come out, baby. Don't you go loving someone.
Don't forget to brush your teeth and don't forget to go to sleep. We'll be here.